Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. After formative years at Deloitte, DCC, Nestle, Unique and Northern Foods, where he oversaw multi-site operations and delivered dramatic turnarounds, Gary Walsh was appointed CEO of Mezan Holdings in 2011, becoming the first non-family member to lead the Kuwait-based conglomerate. Mezan Holdings is one of the Gulf region's leading diversified conglomerates with deep roots in food, healthcare and consumer sectors. Built on over 70 years of legacy, Mezan is recognised for trusted brands, operational discipline and its regional footprint across seven countries. Over his 14-year tenure, Gary guided Mezan through an ambitious growth phase, spearheading its IPO, refocusing on core segments like food and pharmaceuticals, executing acquisitions and disposals and establishing independent governance in a traditional family-led enterprise. Now serving as strategic advisor and non-executive board member in various enterprises, Gary continues to shape strategic initiatives in the region while also pursuing ventures like Plano.ai, I'm sure I've made a mess of that pronunciation, a retail analytics startup tackling real-time inventory insights. Gary, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Aidan. I appreciate it.
No problem at all. Okay, we'll start with this simple one, right? First part of your career was all European-based companies. Then you moved to the Middle East. What are the major differences when it comes to working or running businesses in both regions?
I think from the biggest difference is nationalities.
Okay.
So Mezan, from memory, would have about 74 different nationalities. So if you think about the Gulf region, you know, the vast majority of the work traditionally, Saudi side, has been done by expats.
Okay.
So what you find is you're working with all different nationalities. And bizarrely, each of those different nationalities have a different framework for how they like to approach business. Mm-hmm. So you nearly need to morph yourself into whatever group you happen to be dealing with at the time.
Yeah.
Whereas in the UK or Ireland or Europe, it's much easier because we're all really very homogenous. Yeah. We have a very similar approach to work. Probably the best example I can give you is that what I found difficult at the start was I had become very used to a UK-centric way of working. So you went to a meeting, there was an agenda for the meeting, everybody knew what time it started at, everybody knew what time it was going to end at. If you could finish a little bit earlier,
great.
That'd be great. and you didn't need to necessarily know anybody's name because you could just call them mate.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was how the world worked. When you go and work in Kuwait, you realise that if I go and meet someone for a business meeting, the likelihood is I would spend 55 minutes of the hour talking to them about their wives, their family, their kids, their holidays, where I'm from, where they're from, et cetera, et cetera. And only at the end of the meeting will they go, by the way, what were you here for? And you go, oh, I wanted to look at X. And they go, oh, of course we can help you with X. Why? Because you've built a relationship. Okay. You've built a friendship with them, you know, and they really, really value that. When I moved there first, the chairman, Khaled, Lord of Mercy, used to constantly say to me, oh, I have a friend who does that when we were talking about any business. It took me a long time. I thought, you know, he had great English, but I thought he didn't understand the difference between friend and acquaintance.
Yeah.
No, he understood the difference clearly. These were friends of his that he kept in touch with constantly and could pick up the phone to 1,500 different people. Yeah. So it's a really different way of working. Mm. You know, some of the nationalities are very aggressive, very like Jordanians traditionally are, you know, some of my best friends, but they are very direct, very straight, very aggressive.
Almost Germanic.
Almost Germanic. You know, Indians by comparison are typically fairly deferential, fairly quiet. You know, sometimes with Jordanians, you have to raise your voice to be taken seriously. If you raise your voice with a group of Indians, they'll never tell you the truth. So you have to change. So that was the biggest thing I found difficult at the start, was that kind of EQ to be able to morph into what this situation demanded. The other thing that's very different is that Europe, Ireland, the UK, by and large, you're competing for a larger slice of the same pie. Mm. The pie itself
doesn't grow.
Actually growing. I mean, I mean, probably the most enjoyable time of my career was working in Green Isle. It was a fantastic business. You know, really loved it. Great team of people. If we grew by 2 or 3% a year,
it was a monster year.
Oh my God, this is great. You know, so you got very good at focusing on cost, very good at focusing on efficiencies, very good at focusing on processes. When you go to the GCC, the pie is growing every year. So the disciplines that made you successful in your previous life are not necessarily 100% transferable.
Yeah.
It's nearly about how do you make sure that you're maximizing the growth and trimming as you go.
Yeah.
And probably the best way I can describe it, when I moved to Mizan initially, the company was turning over just less than $300 million and had about 7,500 employees. Now it's turning over about $1 billion and has about 7,500 employees. Mm-hmm. So it was about how did you layer in efficiencies.
Scale without taking on.
We never had to go to a redundancy program or anything. You just grew to accommodate what you had. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you changed the skill sets, etc. But, you know, the focus is really very different. It is on growth. It is on opportunity. And to me, the sweet spot is if you can take the entrepreneurialism that they have naturally there and marry it with that kind of Western approach on processes, systems, and you know, make the entrepreneurialism data-led rather than instinct-led. Yeah. That's the sweet spot.
And what about, you know, when you know, because obviously there's a lot, and Mizan would have been very much a family structure and things like that. But what about that whole kind of hierarchy within, you know, when you go to Asia, there's a very much a hierarchy and you move. Is it the same in the Gulf or is it somewhere in between, you know?
No, it's very much in between. There is a lot of deference to age.
Okay.
But they also are very clear on capability.
Right.
So if you take listed companies in Kuwait, for example, the chairman role in a listed company is by and large an honorary role by law.
Okay.
And it's designed for the oldest brother or the ex whatever. So you put someone into that role as a gesture of respect.
It's almost ambassadorial.
Ambassadorial. Right. But the vice chairman role would be what we would consider a chairman in the West.
Operational, but board focused.
He's the guy as CEO that would be your first point of contact.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's really caked into the society and there's a lot of deference towards age, a lot of deference towards, you know, seniority. But as you've seen in Saudi, you know, with MBS coming in, it really is about capability. Yeah. Age is not the barrier, but we're going to treat it with respect. Yeah. So, you know, for me, you know, setting out on a kind of a more fractional working or non-exec life. I'm 56. You know, I would imagine it's easier to find opportunities as a 56-year-old in the Gulf than it would be as a 56-year-old in Ireland, where there's always the newer, brighter, better coming along. So it is a very different mindset. Not Asian, not Western, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, not good, not good, different or bad, different, just different and very regional.
And I would say if you look at the pace of growth, the pace of acceleration, the pace of change, it works.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I currently live in Dubai and I mean, I went there in 2008. I was very fortunate to go out on a business trip with Tesco. And, you know, we met one of the sheikhs at the time and he explained to us, you know, they intended to have the tallest building in the world, the biggest airport, a metro system. And we're a group of Irish people sitting there going, yeah, right. We've been talking about that for 20 years. You know what I mean?
And we still haven't got them.
You know what I mean? So I went back in 2011. Between 2008 and 2011, you know, Ireland had gone bankrupt and been bailed out by whoever. Mm. Everybody, I think, Dubai had gone bankrupt and been bailed out by Abu Dhabi. The difference was when I went back in 2011, they had the tallest building, they had the metro system, they had the airport, and they were already on the path to how do we grow again. So, you know, I really do think, you know, there's a lot of us, you know, when you live there, you kind of look at that benevolent dictatorship model. And when the right person is at the top of the pyramid, it can work.
Yeah.
It can work.
It always strikes me when I look at either senior executives or entrepreneurs, too, more importantly, so many of them start their career as qualified accountants, and you did the same. What do you think it is about that qualification that makes it very applicable to running businesses?
Firstly, I would say I love being entrepreneurial as long as someone is paying my salary at the end of the month.
Yeah.
No, I think, look, I trained in Deloitte and it was brilliant. I got to see so many different businesses. And I went into it thinking that, you know, accountants ran the world. Yeah. I think what you learn when you're seeing so many different businesses, which most of us don't get a chance to do, you know, you typically start in one company, work your way up, one industry, and stick to it. Yeah. The good thing about something like that is you really get to see a lot. And I think what you realize very early on is that numbers are a great tool in telling the story and in understanding the story, but they're not the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of accountants become entrepreneurs because they realize that they have a different view of the story
than the numbers, and
they can, you know, marry it together. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the breadth of insight that the old training methods gave. Maybe it's the same now, I don't know. But for me, it was fantastic.
Yeah. Talk to me now about the IPO process for Mezzan. You know, I suppose, one, when you went in there, was that always going to be, not necessarily the timing of it, but was the glide path always going to be an IPO for it
when you went in? The glide path, so the Mezzan was controlled by a family called Al-Wazan. And Al-Wazan were moving from the second generation to the third generation. And Al-Wazan was unusual in that five brothers had managed to stay together, which in that part of the region is unusual. And they'd managed to really, you know, take what their father had given them and maximize it.
Okay.
But as the chairman said, you know, I have 54 nieces and nephew. They couldn't agree where to go for lunch, never mind how to run a business. So this isn't sustainable in the long term. So the drive was to find a more sustainable path forward.
But not lose control, our ownership in a way.
Well, not lose the potential,
sure,
if that makes sense. Yeah. I don't think control was there, but potential. Bizarrely, if it was growing rapidly enough that they had to be diluted down, they wouldn't have had a problem.
Okay.
It was the potential.
Okay.
And not allowing, you know, any one faction of the family to mess it up, which can happen. So, you know, the group at the time had a lot of investments that were non-core. We moved them out into a different entity. They had a bunch of properties that were non-core. Well, they were moved into different entities. So at the time, they had esoteric things. They owned the Welsh Parliament, for example, which they leased out. So, you know, obviously they were easy to value in that. Yeah. If you have a bunch of investments, if someone wants to sell their shares in that, those investments can be valued.
Yeah.
If somebody wants to buy them, great. If not, borrow the money, buy them out and move on. Same with the assets.
Yeah.
A trading entity, it's like a house. It's only worth what someone will pay for it. So it became obvious that the logical thing to do was to list it. And, you know, one of the things I would give the family great, you know, kudos for, having lived in the region and seen how it can go, was they didn't necessarily all agree, but they were happy to go with the majority view. And you know, it's been very successful for them, I think, in terms of managing the succession planning, because it's easy.
Yeah.
There's not many people involved, not many family members now involved in the business.
In business, yeah.
You know, they've mostly made their careers outside. And the family, the listed entity throws off a really nice cash flow that they can benefit from. So it's worked out for them. So the path was really about securing the future. Let's debate how.
Talk to me then about what were the major learnings for you going through that IPO process?
Don't do it again. It's not good for your health.
Well, that's an interesting one. We'll come back to that, but then go on.
No, look, I think, again, it was important to really get everybody centered around that as a pathway. You know, you were asking people to give up a lot, people who'd been, you know, very involved in the business for many years, you know, who really had, had grown it from nothing, were suddenly kind of going, so I don't have an office anymore. I'm a director, but what does that actually mean? You know, and, you know, so I think the like with a lot of things in life, communicate. And the second thing was, you know, be ruthless around the execution. You know, you really had to think about what's the plan? How are we going to execute it? How quickly are we going to get there? And really drive everybody along that path. The lessons I learned from it was also, if you've a good story to tell, just tell that story. There's no need to embellish. There's no need, you know, I never realized the amount of people you have to meet during an IPO process and the amount of times that you have to tell your story. So the great thing for me was I'm intelligent enough to know that I'm not intelligent enough to lie. So I had a clear story that I was able to. But the big mistake I made was I didn't realize how much time it would take personally. And if I had my time to do over again, I would have brought more senior management into the business beforehand rather than afterwards. Because I think, you know, you lose impetus because you spend so much time focused on the IPO that you nearly lose impetus around everything else. And I had made a mistake in that I hadn't built a management team behind me that were capable of saying, listen, we don't need you here. We can
you go off and sell the business.
Do whatever you need to do. And we'll focus on the on keeping it on track. So we definitely had a couple of years afterwards, which I think we should have grown faster had I done things differently.
That was the question I was going to, you know, how different was running the company pre and post?
Bizarrely, it was much more fun pre.
Okay.
Why? I could sit with the five brothers and we could decide something and, you know, it was a conversation and it was done. You know, once you explained, look, this is the way governance structure should work. This, you know, these guys are very intelligent, you know, open people. So once you told them this is the way it needed to be done, that's the way it needed to be done. So if I give you an example, we invested in Afghanistan. And so in Afghanistan, at one point we were providing all the fruits and vegetables for the American army. And we had a bakery providing all of the baked goods for NATO. And we were looking at, when we were going in there initially, we also intended to build a water factory. So it was about $150 million investment, you know. And it was the first big investment decision I had asked the board to make before the IPO.
Right.
You know, so I had kind of done all the papers, but it was during the summer, so everybody was traveling, you know. So it was, look, send us through the stuff, you know. And one of the guys around me, he's kind of going, Gary, I'm in a shop. I'm hiding from my wife. I saw this stuff you sent me. Do you think it's a good idea?
Yeah,
I do. Okay, you have my vote. Go ahead. And that was, you know, whereas I was used in Northern, if you wanted to buy, you know,
a set of paper clips,
you know, come with three binders and be prepared to go through them, you know. So, you know, before the IPO, you could make decisions like that and you could get the board unified around those decisions. And you would, you know, because they were all coming from a trading business background, you know, even if it didn't work, they kind of went, we know that's life. You know, your business is risk. You take risks. So before the IPO, we were probably more nimble, more united in a funny way. And I probably spent more time.
Would you say you were more entrepreneurial pre-IPO?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Then post IPO, you have to be more considered. You know, they're not just betting their money anymore. There's now outsiders along. So, you know, we very much moved to, you know, what at the time I would have known from Northern, I'd brought a CFO from Northern who had done a great job getting everything set up before the IPO. So, you know, we really, that's what how we understood it, and that's how we ran. Now, things have obviously changed over the years in terms of the approach to risk, you know, which wasn't really de rigueur in a trading company at that stage. Risk was something for banks. But, you know, it slowed things down. But I'm not sure it was a bad thing to slow things down either. You know, I think, you know,
managed growth as opposed to frenetic growth.
Yeah. And I think if you look at Mizan particularly, Mizan is, you know, I would have always said if you graded my role on a Hay scale, I mightn't grade high on scale, but on scope. I mean, we had everything from Luboy manufacturing, plastic manufacturing, carton manufacturing, chips factories, water factories, meat factories. I then went out and madly bought a medicine factory. So, you know, the breadth was wide.
Yes.
So kind of slowing down a bit and taking the time was not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. You know, but as also, we got bigger. But also doing stuff like that, inevitably, you know, you're diversifying the conglomerate so that, you know, ironically, the bets become less risky because you're doing more of them in different areas.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think, you know, when you think about, you know, wanting the business to be a cash cow for many years to come, diversification is good. So if you look at when I started, I think 98% of the profits came from Kuwait. I think now it's probably down to Kuwait is maybe 60% of the turnover. We had it down further towards 50-50. I always wanted to get to 50-50, but then the medicine company we bought was in Kuwait. Right. So that skewed it the other way again. And I think, you know, for a diversified conglomerate, which is still the model there, you know, that's fine.
Yeah.
And it'll sell other entities as time goes on. Yeah. And we continue to do that, but you
know, just becomes it's a bit like running an investment portfolio. You bits in and out, and you know, you'll change and then move in and move out.
And it's interesting you say that. I think that's probably one of the weaknesses is coming from a family background is that every business has a story.
Yeah,
that was my uncles, my brothers, my cousins, my dad started that. Do you know what I mean? So every business has an emotional. So we definitely weren't as quick to sell businesses as we should have been.
Then in terms of the your interaction and dealing with the board pre and post, because pre, I presume the board was the five brothers pretty much. And maybe a couple of hangers on. And then you move into IPO world and the board changes. How did the board change in terms of post IPO?
I think it became much more professional.
Right.
And I think if you ask them, they would say, and not quick enough.
Okay.
You know, I think, you know, we evolved at the pace that we could evolve at. Mm-hmm. And certainly over the last couple of years, we brought more non-execs in. And that's accelerated the change process. On a personal level, it probably made it more difficult because only three of the brothers stayed on the board.
Okay.
You know, their view was, no, we want non-execs. We want, you know what I mean? We want change. We want...
It was a very progressive viewpoint for them to have.
Incredibly progressive. And yeah. I mean, I would say that the vice chairman, Mohammed Awazan, and you know, I think he initially wrote about doing an IPO sometime in the 90s to his brothers.
Right.
You know, he really had a far-seeing vision of what he wanted. The chairman, Khaled, you know, had, you know, the same in that they would express it differently, but absolutely that's what we need. And, you know, they really were, and still are, you know, it's about, these guys have more money than they could ever spend. And honestly, if you met one of them on the street, you wouldn't know. And one of the things you learn in the Gulf, you know, they say money talks, but wealth whispers.
Yeah.
Yeah, these guys who have real wealth, you genuinely wouldn't know it. They're not the guys driving the flashy cars. They're not the guys wearing the $100,000 watches. Or if they are, it's because their wife bought it for them and they're scared not to wear it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a fear, not a bragging.
So, you know, they really were determined that they had been given something in trust by their father. And it was their responsibility to make sure that it went to the future generations
in the best possible
format yeah. and in the best possible shape to preserve it for the longest possible time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny when you meet the grandkids of the founder, they're all incredibly proud of the fact that their name is associated with the company,
legacy,
with the legacy, you know, and, you know, really would, you know, you could get yourself in trouble very quickly by behaviors that reflected badly on the business, rather than on, you know, performance.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And probably the time where, you know, you could see that most was during COVID, you know, where, you know, I can honestly say, you know, we were a food company and I can tell you I'm a strategic genius, but the reality is that anybody who was in food during COVID did well.
Yeah.
But I can honestly tell you that for the first 3 board meetings during COVID, there wasn't one question about performance.
Yeah.
It was, are people safe? Are they being looked after? You know, we built accommodation for nearly 2,000 employees over 2 weeks to move them out of, you know, areas that were kind of more congested and into areas that we could control ourselves.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It really was a very, you know, fix that.
Mm.
Everything else will look after itself.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is, again, ties into that mindset of legacy. It's not about this year or next year. It's about 3 generations, 4 generations, 5 generations.
So, you know, the Wazans, one of the things that makes them famous in Kuwait is that during the Iraq invasion, the father just opened all the warehouses and told everybody to take whatever they wanted. Right. And everybody wrote checks and IOUs and blah, blah, blah. I don't know where they are now, but because we moved offices, but in the old chairman's drawers, he actually had all of those IOUs and checks, none of which had ever been cashed.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would meet people, you know, I would go to meetings, you know, and they would say, where do you work? You go, did you hear about them during the war?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that mattered. In a funny way, that mattered more to them than whether they were wealthy or poor. That family good name really meant something.
It's the real S in ESG that we all talk about now.
And but done naturally from the heart, and it's I'm sure they won't mind me sharing, but you know, their religion is such that, you know, the way they believe is that if you do something and everybody knows about it, you've got your credit here on earth.
Right.
If you do something privately, you get
credit forever.
Forever.
In the next.
So, you know, one of the things that I always found funny was, you know, they as a family, they would spend a fortune on charity. But their view was, that's not the company. Yeah. The company's job is to make us money.
Yeah. And then we decide how we want to spend our money.
But they don't spend it on a church or a mosque with their name on it. They don't spend it on a hospital with their name on it. They might build a hospital. Mm. They might build a mosque.
But you'll never see their name on it.
You know, I mean, when we went into Afghanistan, you know, we did very well in Afghanistan for you know, probably 7 or 8 years. But, you know, they were paying for orphanages. Mm. They were, you know, doing all sorts of things. And the only reason they would want that I would get to know about it was none of them really wanted to get on a plane to Afghanistan. So it was, can you organize that for us? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I really admire that kind of ESG, but quietly, because it matters to them,
it matters to somebody else and they want to be seen to be
exactly.
doing
they don't care that the shareholders know about it, don't know about it. They prefer they didn't.
Yeah.
That's their business.
And then do you think, when you think about it over your time, because obviously you came from, you know, Western, and it's always one of these things I think about, when you think about that business model and that mindset more than anything else of longevity, right? And you go to Western quoted companies and everything is about either this quarter's earnings or this year's earnings or things. Do you think better business decisions are made with that mindset of, you know what?
1,000%.
Right.
So if you look at it, I had one really, really bad year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything went wrong.
Yeah.
Just everything went wrong. And I remember sitting in my office, I'd sent out the board packs, and the then chairman, Abu Ali, rang me and kind of went, saw the pack. And I went, yeah. And he kind of went, I'm expecting, you know, we need to have a chat. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? He goes, are you okay? Mm-hmm. I went, sorry. He said, Gary, there's nothing I can say that's going to make you feel worse than you feel. I've known you long enough to know how you feel. And he said, you know, honestly, my family have been traders for 70 years. Yeah. You have good years and you have bad years. Yeah. Shake it off. Go again.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's that mindset is incredible and, you know, is very motivating. And because it means you can make a mistake and not kind of have to hide it or worry about it
or prevent you making the next decision.
Yeah. So if you peel back the covers on Mizan, if I came in as a private equity, there are a couple of bets, the medicine division for one, you know, that business, we bought it in 2019. It'll probably split from the rest of the group in 2-3 years time. There was probably 2 years where we could have made money or we could make less money, but set it up to make a lot of money in the long term. Do what's right. Don't worry about this month. Mm. Don't worry about this quarter. Don't worry about do what's right. That was the message very clearly. And now that business is, you know, we've just spent another $100 million on a new factory, which will open hopefully in the next couple of months, you know, because the business is going so well.
Yeah.
But the mentality was, you know, no, do what's right.
Yeah.
We went into Saudi. You know, Saudi, as anybody who's gone in there will tell you, is a tough market. Yeah. Nobody's ever complained about the losses we made. Everybody goes, listen, we're a food company. We want to be a GCC wide. Whatever, we want to be in GCC. Yeah. We have to be in the biggest population.
Yeah.
Do it. Yeah. We'd prefer if you could do it a little bit quicker, a little bit faster. But the underlying decision, no. That's not.
And did that mentality stay post-IPO?
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. And I think it's because, you know, the family still control 63% of the group. They don't at the board. But we're very clear. We don't lie to our investors.
Yeah.
We're very clear about what's going on.
And would the majority of the other 40% be Gulf-based investors?
No.
Would it not?
No. I mean, you get them from all around the world.
Right.
But I think they're investing because we're in the right indexes. We're in the right, you know, they really have to be in you.
Right. Okay.
If that makes sense. And, you know, it's... I would give Munaf Yusuf and Ali Awazan were the two guys who kind of bullied me into doing investor calls every quarter.
Yeah.
I really didn't want to do them. They weren't required.
Yeah.
I'd done the IPO. I really didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of bullied me into doing it. And, you know, later on when the Premier market came and they said, well, these are the requirements, we were already ticking all the boxes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so our comms have always been good, open, honest. And you know, the investors we've got have stuck with us as a result.
Mm. But again, when you have 60% of your shareholder base that are very clearly patient investors, right? It means there's kind of, in terms of the other 40%, they look at it and go, well, there's no point in being an activist shareholder there, right?
Yeah.
So you get the 40% become like-minded to the 60%, so that you kind of get...
Absolutely, right. Absolutely. But I really do think if I look at a lot of the decisions that are made, you know, in the West, private equity struggles in the Gulf.
Mm.
Why? Because there's no need.
Yeah.
You know, people are quite happy to kind of, you're turning the company around, tick.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be hidden. It doesn't need to be, because by and large, their view is, longer term.
Yeah.
It's not short term. It's longer term. Whereas here, the view is, as you say, quarter, half year, year, you know, and you're nearly driving the business to those decisions. Sometimes I'm sure it's great, but a lot of the time it's to its detriment.
And you raise an interesting point, because I do believe that ultimately, and like, you know, with Mizan, you saw the IPO and things like that. But if you look in the Western economies, the number of IPOs is in terminal decline, right? There's actually companies leaving the market and all. And people are saying, oh, you know, what's going to happen? Well, what's happening is there are large pools of capital in the Middle East, in Asia, that are just coming in and going, we want to own these companies. We don't really want them listed because we'd want them to be run in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've got deep pockets and we just take the whole company and here we go. And it just moves on.
And it just moves. And I mean, I think if you look at the Saudi thing, I mean, what fascinates me about what Saudi are doing at the minute is they're nearly putting Saudi at, so all those investments decisions they would have made before, they're still making them. Mm. There's no new magic pot of cash. It's the same pot of cash that's been coming for the last 30 years. The difference is that they're now making them with Saudi as the center of the decision. So we will invest in an electric car company, but we want them to build a factory in Saudi. We will invest in a food company, but we want them to invest in Saudi.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a very smart way of working the capital twice.
Right. Yeah.
Because, you know, you're just driving. Look, you're going to have to make an investment decision in that region anyway.
Financial good and people good, our country good.
And I mean, honestly, if you want to see somewhere changing at pace, I mean, the first time I went there, you know, obviously women would still have been covered. There was no women drivers. You wouldn't have seen a Saudi working unless it was in a senior management role.
Yeah.
You know, now you go, you know, you're going to be greeted with a smile rather than a grimace. Mm. You know, women are driving, people are uncovered. The people who check you into the hotel will be Saudi, you know, and you won't notice a difference. So it's amazing how with that, making sure there are jobs for everybody, they are really driving dramatic change very, very quickly. It's really fascinating.
What were the truly hard points during the journey as CEO to change Mizan?
That's a difficult one. I would say the middle years.
Right. After the honeymoon.
Not even after the honeymoon. I think the IPO gives a business a brilliant sense of purpose.
Right.
You know, and you can get everybody focused on that point in time and this needs to be done for that purpose, you know. I think, you know, in the post-IPO period, I think there's a natural slump because I don't think you have that
Focus.
Single focus. Yeah. And, you know, something to judge every decision against. So I definitely think that was the hardest part. Not that part itself, because we actually traded okay. It was the getting everybody geared up to go again. You know what I mean? You know, we need to
re-energize
in a different way. And I mean, our original plan as a family moving over there was we would do 5 years. So, you know, that was really 4 years to the IPO and 1 year
post.
Yeah. And bizarrely, when we got to the 5 years, our then 11-year-old was the one advocating for us to stay. His attitude was, Dad, we see more of you, you seem happier, we're all happy, why would we
change?
And to the point he was nearly going, look, I'd prefer to go back to boarding school on my own than everybody
move back.
Now, he didn't, but that was his viewpoint. We were kind of going from the mouths of babes. So I think in a funny way, probably part of that was because my personal agenda, you know, and then it took time to just get going again. Yeah. And I think that was where the medicine thing coming along was fantastic, because it was a new
focus
thing to get everybody
energized
around, you know. But I think that was the hardest part.
And it's always a big question I think I have with when it comes to conglomerates, right? And maybe the Middle Eastern mindset is what provides the difference here. But, you know, oftentimes with success comes the risk of distraction. And if you're in a conglomerate, the risk of distraction is even greater, because you're not on one track, you're 15 tram tracks. And sure, what does it mean adding a 16th tram track or a 17th tram track? That's what you do, right? So How did you kind of balance that between, and maybe take it from the perspective of the medicine one, right? Because you didn't have kind of that medicine thing, and then suddenly what said, actually, do you know what? Medicine or pharmaceuticals would fit perfectly in this entity.
Yeah. So I think the medicine one was funny. So we had a small medicine company, medicine distributing, no, not manufacturing, just distributing, just in Kuwait. And I'm a great believer that to succeed in a market in the long term, you need to be first or second in the market, consumer market.
Yeah.
We were sixth. Yeah. So, and I think that was generous. Mm-hmm. We were probably seventh or eighth, truth be told. So we said, look, this isn't core to us. You know, let's sell it. So we went and talked to the bigger guys and realized actually we were cash flow positive in that business and we were profitable. Most of them weren't. So we suddenly went, hang on a second, we have a formula here that seems to be working. By luck or by happenstance, I would say it was great leadership, but you know what I mean. So we set out in that business, okay, we are going to do this differently. And we went and recruited a guy called Rashid Kazal, who is a Kuwaiti gentleman, who's one of the very few Kuwaitis who actually works in that industry. And we brought him on board, gave him our little business, said, turn that around and we're willing to invest. Yeah, or not turn it around, accelerate it, and we're willing to invest. And Rashid did a great job. So when we went and bought factories, to be honest, instead of getting involved in the weeds, I trusted Rashid.
Right.
And we actually, when we bought the, we bought 66% of a different company, and we brought some non-execs who were medical experts to represent us on the board.
Okay.
So it was me, one of the family members, a young guy called Ali Awazan, and non-execs on the board. And the non-execs knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
So, and Ali bizarrely became the day-to-day liaison between me and the business. And that really worked well, you know. So when I stepped back in Mizan, I was replaced not by one CEO, but by two CEOs, one for food and FMCG, and one for medicine.
Okay.
And which was Rashid and Ali. They kind of worked that between them. On the food side, the guy who came in took one look at the org chart, and I think I had 29 direct reports, and he went, what the hell is this? It worked for me because I'd been doing it for so long and I knew, And he's completely restructured that business, and he was right to restructure that business. Do you know what I mean? To make it much more streamlined and organizationally correct. So, you know, change comes, change happens. What we did differently in medicine was we did things right. And then it took someone new to come in and retrofit that in food. And, you know,
it's not really a conglomerate per se. It's really just the two big operating entities. I know there's lots underneath it, but actually, really, it's just two businesses.
Yeah, but the difference is I ran it poorly.
Right.
In that I would have said, but so I have a business in Qatar. I have a business in food in Qatar. I have a business in catering in Qatar. I have two factories in the UAE, one manufacturing meat, one manufacturing snacks, and I have a distribution business in the UK. When we got Strategy And in, you know, they came in and they said, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. You've got factories, put all the factories reporting into an operations guy. You've got wheels, put them all reporting into a distribution guy. I completely got it, and it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I completely bought into it. I just knew I didn't have it in me to do it.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, where stepping aside and letting someone like Amar come in, who took one look at it and said, this is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, it is now the way it should have been, if that makes sense.
There's an idea out there, you know, as a CEO, you don't necessarily get better at the job, but you get faster at making the important decisions. Do you agree?
I absolutely 100% agree.
Right.
And I think the other thing you realise is, you know, most of us get to where we get to in life by being good at what we do. Mm. Yeah. As CEO, you succeed by making sure that the people around you are good at what they do.
Yeah.
And you just have to be good at getting the best out of them. Right. So it's not that you make the decisions quicker. I think that if you surround yourself with the right people, they come with the right recommendation, and you don't feel the need to go back down into the weeds anymore to double check the decision, if that makes sense. Yeah. So, you know, it really fascinates me about how much of the last few years of being a CEO and what I'm doing now revolves around making sure that you have the right people around you. So I'm involved in an AI startup. I mean, I barely know how to spell artificial intelligence, never mind how it all works. Yeah. But, you know, I'm surrounded by people who really understand vision and AI. Mm. And, you know, you just have to kind of go, I know enough to know that I trust them.
Yeah.
And leave them at it, you know.
And that move from being executive to non-executive, how have you found that move?
Brilliant.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Liberating.
Liberating. I read a book. I used to work in a company called Robert Roberts, which was part of DCC. And it was a fantastic place to go after Deloitte's. I worked for a guy called Tom Gray, who was the finance director. And Tom had a brilliant philosophy. If I left work 3 days in a row quicker than he did, earlier than he did, he gave me more work. Yeah. So you were learning
all the time.
And it was a great team. But there was a guy there who left to set up his, he was production director, left to set up his own coffee shop. And he put me onto a book called The Elephant and the Flea, which was written by a guy called Charles Handy. And basically, that book contended that your dad and my dad worked 40 hours a week for 40 years, retired, sat in a chair and died 5 years later. And that was life. Our generation would work 70, 80 hours a week for 20 or 30 years and then would retire. But retirement would morph into meaning that you would go and do what you wanted to do, what it made you enjoy life rather than having to do it with a financial incentive.
Yeah.
So when I left Mizana, I described to everybody that I retired, and everybody looked at you kind of going, huh? Mm. You're young, you know what I mean? Okay, I'm doing fractional working. Yeah. Honestly, it's much more fun because I'm only involved in the aspects that I want to be involved in.
Yeah.
I don't own the result.
Mm.
You know, in many cases, I help with the process, I help with the outcome, but I don't own it.
Yeah.
So I don't go to bed at night
fretting over,
you know, and it's bizarre the things I notice. I mean, for example, I'm here having a conversation with you. I guarantee you, if I was having this conversation with you 2 years ago, I'd be thinking about five different things and looking to see why my phone is buzzing while we're having the conversation.
Yeah.
Now, I'm actually present for most things that I'm doing because I'm only doing them because I want them to do it. So for me, how would I put it? We did the World Cup. We did all the commissaries in the World Cup in Qatar. It nearly killed me. Why? Obviously, we were going to supply alcohol. The decision was made, you know, that alcohol would not be allowed.
Mm.
You know, the model for the income for everything was 60% dependent on alcohol. So, you know, we wound up having to start. So I flew in as the CEO, you know, with a great team in Qatar, nothing against the team. I flew in, you know, intending to be there to kind of meet a few of the FIFA people, make coffee, tell everybody they were a great job. You know, the typical CEO, rah, 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 get it up and running, leave.
Good luck now.
You know, and wound up being there for, you know, 2.5 months, actively and like literally walking stadiums at 3 o'clock in the morning to be sure they were ready for the next day.
Yeah.
And you know, that brought home to me, do you know what? Why the hell are you doing this anymore? You don't enjoy it. You know, you're not 22 anymore. You can't do this anymore. So bizarrely, that for me was a brilliant tipping point in terms of saying enough.
Mm.
You've done. You've done that. You know what I mean? And I've been approached by some really great companies about going in as CEO. the most I say is, do you want me to recommend some people?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm only taking the call as a courtesy to whoever's ringing me. I really, that part of my life is done. Yeah. And I'm so relaxed with the fact it's done. For me, without that, I think I'd still be doing what I was doing. I don't think that, but that gave me a tipping point. I sat here in the house and I flew, bizarrely, everybody else wanted to go to the final. Mm. I flew out of Qatar while the final was on to come home for Christmas. I sat in my house in Terran, Europe, catatonic for about 2 weeks. I mean, my wife wanted me to talk to someone because she thought I had PTSD, you know what I mean? But, you know, for me, it was a great, okay, that just reinforces, I don't want to be doing this anymore. Yeah. And I also am old enough to know myself well enough to know that I couldn't do the CEO gig other than how I do it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying someone else, you know, Amr does it very different to how I would do it. Not better, not worse, just different.
Yeah.
But I'm self-aware enough to know that I would still be the idiot jumping on a plane every second day.
So do you obsess about the small things, or did you obsess about the small things?
I obsessed about the stupidest things. And that's where I'm saying, you know, if you surround yourself with good people, they will drag you out of the detail, you know, and you know, if my regret is always not having enough good people. And I think if I'd recruited 100 good people, I'd still be saying, I don't have enough good people. I think as CEO, you worry about, you know, for me as CEO, I worried about if I drove by a van and the livery on the van wasn't right.
Okay.
It annoyed me. Right. And I mean, I think we had like 1,500 vans, you know what I mean? If I went to a shop and there wasn't the product there, that would annoy me. Yeah. It's funny, I mentioned Green Isle before. One of the gentlemen I want to see when I'm home is a guy called Liam Hennessy, who was the sales manager in Green Isle while I was here. And Liam was in Rathfarnham Shopping Centre one day with the store manager and the freezer manager, complaining that there wasn't enough Donegal catch on display and he wasn't happy with the Goodfellas pizza display. And he was explaining to them, my boss lives up the road, and there was a lot of expletives in the conversation. I'm just, toning it down. You know, my boss just lives up the road. He's going to be in here on Saturday. Yeah. If it's not right, I'm going to get a call
Saturday afternoon.
And we're going to go and do 10 stores, you know what I mean? And unfortunately, my mother was reaching in to get Donegal catch at the time. So I get this phone call. Do you have an older gentleman called Liam works for you? Yeah, why? He's giving out about you. And, you know, that was one great thing about, you know, the chilled industry and Green Isle. You really got that attention to detail. Retail, and you really believe that retail is detail and they drilled it into you. So the problem with Mizan was, as it got bigger and bigger, there was more and more
detail. And you couldn't possibly take all of the detail.
No, and you know, but it is, retail is detail. Mm. You know, it's the great thing about AI is it reduces that complexity now. You know, before, you know, you get a report that says you're not on shelf in 3,000 outlets. Great, what do you want me to do? Ring 3,000 sales? What do you want me to do with that? Whereas AI now, you're not on shelf in 3,000 outlets. So I'm going to tell Frank about those 10. I'm going to tell John about those 10. You know, so the world is changing rapidly. But retail will always be about detail.
How do you make decisions, data-based or gut feel?
Before I went to the Middle East, I would have said 100% data-based. That's the way you were trained.
Yeah.
That's the way you were trained. I would say, having lived in the Middle East, I still put a heavy emphasis on data, but there is definitely trust in the people and trust in your gut.
Yeah.
And I also think as you get older and more experienced, you realise that sometimes there isn't a right or wrong decision. There's just making a decision and then making that decision work. You know, I think too often you forget that not doing something is a decision in itself.
And might be the right decision.
Yeah. But make it as a decision and say, I'm not going to do anything rather than neglect it, you know, because it's smelly or it's, you know. So for me, I think, you know, I would say I would still like to think 80% data-based, but 20%.
A gut overlay.
And look, you know, all of the decisions in the West are made based on data.
Yeah.
A lot of companies fail in the West.
Yes, yeah.
You know, so, you know, you kind of realize there is a...
You can't blindly follow the data.
You've got to have a bit of magic sauce. You've got to have a belief in that category, those people, whatever it is, and overlay that on the data.
Yeah. It's funny, you mentioned you would have hired more people. So in terms of what's your philosophy around, you know, hiring talent or developing from within?
80-20 if I could.
Right.
So I'd like to see 80% of the people come through and 20% coming from outside. If I look at companies that like, sorry, go you know, I'd probably use Green Isle a bit because it's Irish based and it's people that will who listen to this will probably understand. But they were phenomenal for bringing people through. True. You know, the work culture, the way that, you know, and it really drove a performance level. But what they were also brilliant at was saying, yeah, but even though we have a guy who could do that job, we'll bring someone in from outside because we know that we need to keep refreshing the ideas, refreshing the...
You don't want groupthink developing. Yeah.
So, you know, the Northern were the same. They invested a lot in training. St. Ival, when I worked there, I mean, I couldn't believe the amount of money they poured into training me. I mean, it was incredible. And I'd always be grateful for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really did spend a lot. So I really believe in bringing people through. It become, you know, but you've got to avoid groupthink as well. You've got to...
You have to refresh the pool every now and again.
Now and then. Yeah. And, you know... There's too many, you know, I used to really admire Superquinn. Superquinn were brilliant. Mm. And then they started telling everybody how brilliant they are.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you lose it. Yeah. The second you start doing that, you lose it. But the really good companies, they maintain that excellence, but they keep bringing people in to refresh the ideas, you know. And maybe those people don't work out.
Yeah.
Not because they're not good people.
No.
Just they don't fit.
But maybe the legacy that they leave is that something slight has changed.
Think about this. Yeah. See that differently, you know. And, you know, it's... And particularly in the Middle East, you know, what you have to remember, we talked earlier on before the podcast, I mean, the expat workforce there is huge. Mm. Right? And everybody's there to make money.
Yeah.
Everybody's there to feed a village back in wherever.
Wherever, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if they can make... if they can do that a crooked way or a straight way and they can do it quicker crooked, they'll do it quicker crooked. Yeah. So in the Middle East in particular, you learn the value of bringing people through because you know you can trust them.
Do you hate losing or love winning?
Sorry, say that again.
Do you hate losing or love winning?
Hate losing.
Do you hate losing?
Hate losing. I was talking to one of my partners in the AI venture and something we'd been pushing at. And you know, we found, we started down one path, but we found a much richer vein, you know, but I still believe there's value in the harder path.
Yeah.
But obviously we've got to focus on
the value,
And, you know, I was saying it to them the other day and I say, Nick, you know, I just hate losing, you know. And the conversation went on and he rang me 3 days later and he said, look, you really need to get over that. Mm. If you're going to survive in an entrepreneurial world, the win is that you invested money and you're getting a return on that money. Yeah. How?
Doesn't matter. Yeah.
And intellectually, I know he's right.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah. You know?
But you can't, the DNA is the DNA.
My wife always says to me that I'm not good at celebrating the wins.
Mm.
So how do I know the difference between the good days
and the bad days?
Yeah. But it's just, when I was in Green Isle, we were fortunate enough to win the Irish Exporter of the Year. And I didn't go to the award ceremony. The guy, Paul Renan, who's a great marketeer, went and picked up the award, and fair play to him. And the next day I was supposed to appear on the morning show. So our CFO, JJ Ryan, appeared on the morning show as Gary Walsh. and that would be because I was on to the next thing. Mm. That's just the way my mind works. Away from driven rather than towards.
Yeah. And then fear of failure then a big driving force for you through your career?
Yes. Up until I was about 40.
Right.
Absolutely. And I think I did an NLP course. Have you ever done NLP?
Oh, yeah.
Neuro-linguistic programming. So the CEO in Northern kind of asked me to do it for development. I think he just thought I was a bit mad and I needed to calm down a bit. And that was great. The one thing you realize, I went into NLP going, oh, well, I'll be able to read people and I'll be able to manipulate them. But what you realize when you start studying it is that actually it's about knowing yourself and controlling yourself.
Yeah.
And you know, you realize that you're much happier if you can be driven towards something rather than running away from something the whole time.
Yeah.
Or, you know, so that fear of failure, you know, I've tried to morph into joy of success. Mm. Not always successfully, but I've tried to make that journey.
Is there a coincidence that you said up till about 40, which would have been around the time you went and joined Mizan, and the different mindset that the trading guys, those traders have?
Yeah, possibly. You know, it's the, I mean, I did, when we IPO'd, I did turn up to ring the bell. Mm. My wife made me though, but I was willing to go along with it, you know what I mean? And yeah, possibly it is, but it's, I definitely believe that you're happier in that.
Mm.
Bizarrely, I believe you're more driven by fear of failure.
Yeah.
Or certainly I was.
Yeah.
It's funny, I mean, it's if you listen to Paul O'Connell, he was very much in the fear of failure.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I think most people as they get older look back and go, God, I wish I had.
Yeah.
You know, but you did. But you know what? It's funny, you know, I don't know about you, but people always say to you, you know, if you could go back and change something. And I kind of go, look, I'm quite happy where I am.
Mm.
I'm quite happy with who I am. So no, I wouldn't change anything. Mm. Doesn't mean I haven't made mistakes. I've made lots of them. It doesn't mean that there's people I wouldn't walk up to and say sorry for the way I behaved if I met them again tomorrow. But I think if you're happy with how you've turned out,
Then
everything that was on the journey contributed to that journey. Yeah. So no, it's but I definitely wish I had taken more joy in the wins.
So in that vein, then, what advice would you give to young people?
I honestly believe the best piece of advice I can give to anybody is find what makes you happy, and if you can find what makes you happy, you'll never work a day in your life. You know, I've been incredibly fortunate that I don't believe I've ever worked a day in my life. I've enjoyed the good days and the bad days. I've enjoyed the 16-hour days, the 20-hour days. It never felt like work because I was enjoying it. So if I was a young person today, you know, I think when you and I were growing up, you know, you came out of school, you came out of college, you were going to be a lawyer, a solicitor, an accountant, a bank manager. You know, there was very narrow paths that you were being forced down. People today,
the world is their oyster, literally.
And find, you know, work out what makes you happy. Yeah. And if it doesn't make you happy,
move on. Yeah.
Don't stick with it. I mean, we were saying earlier on before the podcast, we know lots of people who've stayed in jobs, not because they love them, but because they're trapped in them.
Yeah.
You know, any young person today, find what makes you happy.
Yeah.
Really. And you'll have a brilliant life. Whether, you know, you won't worry about the material things because you'll be enjoying what you're doing. And bizarrely, you'll be successful at whatever it is because you're enjoying
it. Because your frame of mind, your frame of reference is different.
Yeah.
It's about what makes you happy and therefore what's deemed to be successful.
Yeah. So, I mean, that'd be the one piece of advice.
Right. We've come to that moment. The final question. And here we go. Let's have a look. All right. right. Now, interesting this one. Which skill that you have has stood to you the most in your career or in business?
Skill. Data analysis. Without a shadow of a doubt. I really believe that if you understand, like Aidan, you're probably far more numerate than I do. You probably understand numbers far more than I do. But I really believe that if you understand numbers, you can sit with someone and you can understand clearly whether the story they're telling you is right, wrong, or indifferent.
Yeah.
And you can help them find solutions much easier based on data. And, you know, if anybody wants to pursue a career in business, even if you want to be in marketing, even if you want to be in people.
You've got to understand the numbers.
Make sure you understand the numbers and make sure it's not a trial to you to understand them. That would be that. So for me, that's the skill set that really has stood to me. And, I thank everybody involved in beating those or encouraging those into me. But it's brilliant. Yeah. If you understand the numbers, life is easy. Business life is easy.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Gary Walsh. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.